Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendiger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And today we're going to be talking about low-code, no-code development, the IKEA of programming.
You know, you laugh, but that's the only furniture I can build.
Well, I mean, and low-code is the only code that you can develop, so it kind of fits.
You're not wrong.
All right, so the first article is four security concerns for low-code and no-code development. And shocking. This comes to us from CSO Online. All right, so no-code or low-code or no-code development tools are platforms that use a drag-and-drop interface to allow, you know, people who don't really understand a programming language, typically business folks or analysts, to create or modify applications to get something done. And some examples are Salesforce Lightning, FileMaker, Microsoft Power Apps, Google App Maker. And anybody who has a Mac, there's an application on there called Automator, which I actually am a pretty big fan of. I've used it a few times for different things. It's not as powerful as I would like it to be, but still pretty cool. And of course, there's some SOAR products such as Palo Alto's XSOAR that facilitate or, you know, allow for the low code, no code.
Yeah, I don't have any experience with any of the rest of those, but I've used XSOAR before. And it, I know it just has kind of a library of all the automations it can do on the left-hand side. And then you just drag and drop and connect them and kind of fill out the inputs and outputs of each one. So it's very easy.
Yeah, that's very similar to the way that Automator works on the map. You have a, basically a list of applications on the left-hand side and you click on it and then it gives you a list of actions. And then you drag those over to a panel. And then there's like a, if it produces an output, then it'll like feed into the next one. And then you can drag something else that takes that output. And then, you know, daisy chain them like that. And the cool thing about the Automator app is you can save it as an executable, or you can save it as, or maybe even together, as a menu contextual item. So you could produce a workflow and then right click on a file, go to the context menu for that file, and then execute this workflow that you've already created. And of course, you'd only want to do that if it were relevant to file manipulation, but pretty nice. And just because you have, you know, low code or no code with this drag drop GUI or whatever, that doesn't mean there are not any security concerns with it. It's all magic. And this article talks about four concerns in particular, and we'll be going through those.
Wow, I thought we were just going to end our discussion right there.
We could. I'm kind of tired. All right. So the first one is low visibility into the low code, no code produced applications. And, you know, that's because these apps are kind of like black boxes. You take up, you know, like for the Automator, you take that thing and you drag it over to the right hand side, which kind of puts it into the script or the code or whatever, but you have no idea exactly what the code is behind that. You're just assuming that that code is doing stuff in a proper manner. And one of the ways that this article proposes that should be introduced, or some vendors may be introducing this to kind of get around that kind of the opaqueness of that code, is a software build of materials. So they list out all the components that make up that back end, along with any associated vulnerabilities for those back end snippets. All right. And the next one is insecure code. And the idea here is kind of ties into the first one as well, in that opaqueness, and that each of those boxes or each of those pieces of code that represent or are represented by that GUI interface are completely unknown to the person that's doing it. So you don't know if they've properly built that section of code, not necessarily that there are any vulnerabilities in it, but if that's even well-developed code. And it's kind of like, if you're searching for a problem, and I've kind of done this before, you know, search Stack Overflow for saying, hey, I've got this problem. And then you steal code from Stack Overflow or wherever you find it. And then you plug that into your program. I've done that before, but I've never done it in the context of not understanding what it does. you know, I'll pull it off there and say, oh, that's a good idea, but I understand the function of that code. It's not like I've just taken for granted that I run this thing and then it spits out the output I want.
Yeah, I know a big thing lately has been the use of open source package kind of built into things that have been sometimes out of date for years, especially if you use pre-compiled code like this. You know, you may be using a version from 2 years ago, and maybe they used an open source version from 3 years ago, but you know, the currently available one is much newer and updated, but you can't update it yourself. You have to wait for the vendor to update it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, now that I think about it, this kind of reminds me of third-party Python modules that you install with PyPy or whatever that, you know, aren't necessarily, they don't come with Python, but you can get them and someone else has written them after the fact. Even though with Python, though, it's not exactly a black box because you can always go in and read those modules and see exactly what they do. But often, and I'm just guilty of this, I take for granted that the module does what they say it's going to do.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole point of object-oriented programming, right?
I would say so.
Yeah.
And so one of the other things that they recommend that you can do, or one of the recommendations that they have for mitigation against this insecure code, is asking for security scan results from the vendor, you know, either from a SaaS or a DAS solution, which is static and dynamic application security testing. That's where, you know, you have an application which is designed to scan codes for typical mistakes made in coding, you know, buffer overflows, things of that nature. And so you ask for the results from that testing in order to give some kind of assurance that the code that they've produced is not poorly written.
And maybe sometimes you'll get it.
Yeah, because I haven't dealt with this before, I can't really say if any of the vendors really subscribe to these kinds of things, either software build materials or providing, you know, application security testing results. But it would be my guess that these are probably going to be the exception and not the, because one of the things they suggest in here is that software as a service as this kind of programming solution. You know, you have software of a service that provides a low code, no code interface. And I assume that's kind of what Salesforce Lightning is. And if you do have one of these services that is a SaaS, ask them for their industry certifications, ISO, SOC 2, FedRAMP. And this isn't going to directly impact the security of the application that you're dealing with. But the assumption here would be that if they've gone through the process of getting ISO or FedRAMP certified, that their practices in general are good. So this may or may not help. I guess you'd say the mileage could vary on this.
That's fair.
All right. And number three is out of control shadow IT, you know, which everyone is terrified of. And the fear here is that you're going to get somebody who's not in IT, buys this application, this low code, no application, builds an application, and then uses it to manipulate or store or manage sensitive organizational data or personal data or PII or HIPAA or who knows what. And then that, because it has not been vetted by IT, who knows the quality of that application, whether it was, you know, produced by a fly-by-night place or if it's a quality vendor that actually has a good application or whatnot. And you also don't understand the way that data is stored or protected within the application.
I mean, because IT keeps saying no. If IT would stop saying no, then maybe they could run it through IT.
That's true. And I think that's one of the things that I know I've run into with different IT organizations, just being in security and working with IT orgs to try to get security stuff accomplished within there is but just based on my own personal experience, IT organizations are not as service oriented as you would like them to be for internal customers. You know, where their job is to actually make sure that you were able to get your job done versus they see you as a peer or something like that. Whereas if you are a man on the street dealing with your company, they see that person as a customer and want to make that customer happy, but internal customers, not so much. So I think it's a really a mindset that's important for, and this goes for security as well, that security, at least as far as, you know, engineering and other aspects of security, should have a customer focused mindset, a customer service mindset in saying, well, how can I help you get what you need done? And not say no, but say, you know, let's do this a different way. You know, I understand, truly understand what your customer is trying to do within the business, and then work with them in order to facilitate them getting that done, versus saying no and then letting them flounder for themselves trying to figure out how they're going to get their job done without this thing that they were asking for. Mm-hmm. And the last one is business disruption. So, and this kind of ties into the out of control shadow IT partially with, you know, you build one of these no code applications, whether it's, you know, been vetted or not with the IT organization. And then this thing that you've built causes an outage, or it goes down, or it fails to work like you expected. And if you've built that into your business processes, critical business processes, and that's failed, you know, then what do you, and they're suggesting
your automation's down, you do nothing. Sorry.
Yeah, you weep, maybe? I don't know. But what you might want to consider is that if you deploy this thing, how were you doing this work before you deployed it? And maybe have that as your BCDR for whatever this thing is while you repair the problem here. Because if you're relying on a third party in the cloud or something and their low code, no code application, they're down, it should be treated like any other SaaS solution that is an integral part of your business, on how you're going to do your business continuity disaster recovery for that application. And they're suggesting here that SLAs are going to solve this. And I'm like, well, SLAs really are useful only when it fails. That doesn't prevent failure. So maybe you can recoup some money with it, but that's certainly not a panacea or something that's going to solve the problem versus kind of mitigate the problem, if you will. And of course, why should you? Well, the more, the better and more these types of applications and frameworks that are out there, the more you're going to see them in your business and see your business partners want to leverage these in order to get things done. So be prepared to deal with this in your organization. Yeah. I haven't yet, but I expect that I will sometime.
Well, as I understand it, robotic process automation is very much kind of like this. It's almost like a screen recording thing where you turn it on to record the screen and you do your whatever you want automated. And then it records, you know, the mouse goes to this point, then it clicks here, then it does this. So yeah, I know that a lot of business processes, the big push right now is for robotic process automation or RPA for these business processes. So if you don't think you have it going on in your environment, you probably do. You just don't know about it. This is very much the shadow IT side.
Yeah, and there is an application, or I don't know if you want to call it a scripting language per se, called AutoIt, which does exactly what Matt's talking about, which I have used before to do some GUI-only things, which were necessary as part of a scripting thing I was working on.
And if you're not familiar with AutoIt, you should be, because it's very commonly used for Trojans and backdoors. So I've seen many... I've seen many pieces of malware that use it.
See, that just tells you how awesome it is.
What's interesting is when the first stage of the malware will download and install the AutoIt executable, and then it will like download the script for the AutoIt. It's very interesting. Although, you know what, thinking about it, I wonder if any of them are using it to also capture the screen, since it can do that anyways.
How do you mean it's very interesting?
Well, it's interesting because it downloads like a legitimate product to run the AutoIt scripts that are the actual malware. Now I thought AutoIt was just basically a scripting language to automate stuff. I didn't realize that it could do the screen capture like you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm wondering. Mouse movements. I'm wondering what specifically it does, if that's what AutoIt does. Interesting. Like, I've seen it as malware before and we've removed it, but I've never like deep dived into what it does specifically. Now I'm kind of wishing that I'd gone a little deeper on this.
Yeah, it's not surprising because there are some applications which you can only interface with through a GUI. And when that's the case, that's where AutoIt comes in. Because if there's no API or command line interface for an application, it's all GUI driven. then you really need something like AutoWit in order to help you automate that portion of it if you're going to do that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I always thought of it more as like a just a scripting language like Python.
Nope.
Next time I see it, I'll have to, you know, maybe we'll install AutoIT on something and then see if we can figure out what it does specifically.
Yeah, I think it's a good, I think it's a good tool to have in your kit bag in addition to regular scripting languages. Because like I said, sometimes you want to automate something, but you have no command line ability to do so. And AutoIT can fill that gap. Because I've actually had Python call AutoIT execute something.
That's funny.
And then take the output from it.
Yeah.
But anyway, the next article. A hacker group has been framing people for crimes they didn't commit. And this is from Gizmodo. And what's going on here is exactly what it says. So there's exactly what
kidding,
the headline
right?
says.
You're yeah. kidding.
No, this is not like a congressional bill that's titled one thing and then does something else.
The Saving America Act that sells it off to private industry.
Well, that's all you define. Depends on your definition as a saving.
Yeah, that's fair.
So anyway, there's a group called, when I read this article, it seemed like the people who had written the paper up on this are the ones who named this group, called it Modified Elephant.
That is such a weird name. Are we talking like sure exactly a cyborg elephant? How modified? Just like one tusk modified or? I mean, I guess it's been modified with binoculars and surveillance gear.
Sure.
I mean, I may remove that because it was dumb, or I may leave it in there so everybody knows just how dumb I am. It could go either way.
Maybe it's a second story elephant. But Modified Elephant was targeting people in India for surveillance over the last decade, as well as planting evidence on the devices which they've broken into. Now, once this evidence was planted, then conveniently, these folks were arrested by the government. And the evidence which was found on the laptop, which had been planted there, is used to keep them in jail or to prosecute them for crimes.
My God, that's so weird.
It's purely coincidental.
Purely coincidental.
And the most prominent case is one of an activist named Rana Wilson, who was arrested in 2018 for plotting to overthrow the government. There was a Word document with assassination plans for the prime minister, which was found on the device. And a forensics company, I assume was hired by the defense, went through that laptop where the document was found and found that it was actually placed there by malware. And the malware had been there for 22 months.
Now, that's actually really interesting to me. I don't know how you, so let's kind of think about this forensically. You can definitely tell from the metadata on the file what time it was placed on there, assuming it wasn't time stopped, for sure. You can tell using things like the last access, like you could tell maybe if somebody opened the file on there using Word, if there's a entry from, you know, because it keeps things like the last 10 files accessed and stuff like that. How can you tell if it was placed there? I mean, maybe it had metadata showing it was from the internet, because Windows does flag files that are downloaded from the internet as specifically being from the internet. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I don't know enough about forensics, but I don't know how you would authoritatively say that the document was placed there via malware unless you had some way of saying that it was written to disk when nobody else was using the computer.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, like it was written to disk at 12:30 a.m. and you can show that, you know, he leaves work every day. Like it's only at work or whatever. It's only at home and he was at work when it was written or something like that.
Or he was not even, there was no login user.
Yeah, going through the login. Yeah, that would definitely be. Yeah, no user. And then I guess if you found the malware, you could probably figure out maybe times it was running if you've got that evidence.
Yeah. What was also suspicious was the name of the file. I apparently did not write it down, but it was something like leader_assassination_2018.pdf or something like that.
I mean, that's how I save all of my, you know, theoretically illegal plots. I put them all in Word documents on my hard drive and I name them very effectively. So they'll be very easy to find when the police come around.
Well, that, I don't think that wasn't so much a tell for me as the underscores, because ever since we've gotten away from the 8.3 naming convention for files, mm-hmm. I have not named a file with an underscore in it.
Oh, I still do.
Because you can put spaces in there.
Yeah, but those are a pain in the butt on the command line.
Yeah, and no regular person is going to do the underscores in the name of the file. That makes me think that those were in there for ease of manipulation via the command line to move that file around the spaces. So I think that's a dead giveaway, but that's a sure indicator that that was not put on there by a human, in my opinion.
Yeah, that does make sense. It does make it easier to deal with.
So one of the things that they have in the paper was that this appeared to be a group that's their actions were in line with the government, coincidentally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally, totally, completely not connected to the government at all, right?
Right. Because they put malware on this box and they were spying and planting evidence, but they weren't blackmailing or anything else to make money, which seems to indicate maybe they're just civic minded and weren't looking to make a profit on their nefarious actions.
I mean, didn't you know that there's a whole cadre out there? That's what Anonymous is doing these days. It's putting malware on everybody's laptop and it's reporting to the FBI, anybody that's got some CP or anything on there.
Yeah, good
civic
for them.
Civic minded.
So this has also been seen, not this particular group's work, but this has also been seen in Turkey as well. But the thing that I was thinking about as far as this goes, and what was written in the paper, was that this group is not very good at what they do. Their TTPs and their malware were very substandard or poorly written or poorly designed pieces of software. So that got me thinking about, well, is it really an outside group that is doing this as a cutout for the government to give the government plausible deniability, or is it government employees because of how crappy it is? Because there's no real incentive for them to do this great, you know, to do it in a well, a highly sophisticated manner, because they know that there's no downside to them doing this in a poor mate. Because if it gets caught, you know, by whoever it is they're targeting, they can't really go to the government and say, hey, I found this thing, and the government's going to do anything about it and track them down.
You know, what's interesting about that too, is that this kills me that they've been doing this for the last decade. And they had the malware on that activist's laptop for 22 months, and they're so bad at this. That just hurts.
Yeah, maybe they have high turnover.
It's just no. I'm just saying it's bad. It's disappointing that people can't detect this sort of thing yet. That's all. So bad at their job, like how are they still getting in?
Well, depending on the savviness of their targets, maybe their targets are not running any endpoint security products or keeping their systems up to date or anything like that. So it could be that both sides of the coin are not doing great OPSEC.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. And they seem to be using it. Didn't they say that they were using a different piece of malware or a different thing, something to spy specifically on their phones that maybe they used to introduce their malware as a root cause for how they got in?
Oh, well, this is going to be a shocker, but they were using NSO group malware on the phones.
Yeah. So that's interesting, though, because they're using NSO group malware on the phones, and then they're using their own crappy homegrown stuff on the laptop.
Well, I have some speculation on why that's so. They spent all their budget on the NSO group stuff. And they could not afford good malware for the computers. They're like, oh, well, we'll just do our own then. Save some money.
Well, it's not like they needed to spend much more. It worked fine, apparently.
Not well enough, because this group, the Arsenal Consulting, or I guess just Arsenal Consulting, was able to analyze the laptop or the computer on which this malware and the evidence was found and determine that it was planted there by this malware. Which is kind of interesting that they were able to get their hands on the device in order to do the analysis. I guess because it's in the Indian legal system, they were able to use the aspects of the way the Indian court system works in order to get access to the device in order to do the analysis, which is, you know, quite lucky for them.
Yeah, I'm surprised they let it out. Or maybe the government didn't seize it first. Because if the government seized it and the government knew that, you know, they had put it on there, I can't see how they would ever let it go to a forensic. Be like, no, can't have it. Sorry.
I think the government definitely seized it first because that was part of their evidence collection to throw these people in jail. What I'm saying is that once they seized them and charged this person with a crime, it then entered the Indian court system, and the bureaucracy of the Indian court system allowed for this evidence to be analyzed by the defense. And there wasn't really anything they could do to prevent it without tipping their hand or something.
I guess that still smacks of incompetence to me, because you'd think if they were competent, then they would have lost it.
Well, this also could be a scenario where they're doing parallel construction and the two agencies within the government that are doing this are not talking to each other. So you have the one group that's putting the malware on their planet, and then they're tipping off the other group to say, hey, this guy's doing this thing or whatever, but not letting them in the details about how they know that this is going on or how they know the evidence is on the laptop. So if you were to use this in the context of America, you have the NSA that would break into the laptop, plant the evidence, and then call the FBI and say, hey, this dude is trying to overthrow the government. You're going to find evidence on his laptop, but not telling him any details that the NSA is actually the one that planted the evidence there.
No, you're
so the
fair.
FBI treats That's it fair. As a regular case.
Yeah, because they wouldn't want to reveal that, because then it would get leaked.
Right.
Nope, that makes more sense. That makes more sense. So I was kind of curious about what happens if this moves over here. I took a look back. I know I've definitely heard in the past that there are US cases where people claim that the child pornography materials that were on their computer were not theirs and somebody else must have added it. And I couldn't actually find any cases. I mean, I spent a whole 15 minutes on Google this morning, so it was real tough, real in-depth research.
Yeah.
But I did find one case in October 2002 where forensic experts found a Trojan on the computer where someone was being charged, and that was enough to get them to free them from that.
And the article, so they were acquitted in that case?
I believe so.
Oh, wow.
And the article also mentioned in 2003, there were extortion cases where the attackers threatened to plant CP on the user's computer, which actually makes me wonder if this is going to come back as a future item. I'm surprised we haven't seen it really as an attack threat on kind of the current suite of attacker extortion attempts.
Yeah, that is interesting. I had an associate one time who was a pen tester who hypothesized that one way to totally screw a company would be to spam them with child pornography in email.
Yeah, trying to remove that from email would be a real pain.
Well, because the assumption would be that some of that's going to get downloaded to every workstation in the enterprise. So then the workstation has got child pornography on it then.
Wow, that is devious.
Well, imagine though that instead of ransomware, it actually spread child pornography throughout an enterprise too.
Oh my God. Because you have to call in the cops and you've got to do like full workups to make sure that everything's removed off of everything.
Right.
You're going to have people quitting probably because they'll open it up and be like, I don't want to see this. This is not like.
Yeah, this is not cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was thinking that, you know, in a scenario like that, you could shut down an entire company and maybe even cause them to go under by preventing them from being able to do business. Mm. Because imagine if you did this kind of on the DL and it infiltrated all their backups. So they had to destroy all their backups too, because it contained child pornography.
You know, you could do it. You wouldn't even necessarily have to spread it everywhere. If you really wanted to mess with the company, you could put it on like the CEO's laptop or something and then short their stocks or something and then release it.
Oh yeah. If you're just thinking about profit motive versus burn the place down.
I mean, why not both, right? But
why constrain yourself?
Yeah, you start with one or two, and then about the third, you know, once their third C-level has caught with CP, they're going to be like, wait a second, something's going on here. This is very strange.
Well, it's just part of Pizzagate. They're all in on it.
Yeah, I feel like the lawyers are like, man, we just have the worst luck picking people to hire. Yeah. Or, you know what, alternatively, you could do, if you wanted to, again, do the slow and low thing, start putting it on network shares using the accounts that you've compromised so that like the trail points back to the network administrator or whoever. And then you get people like pointing fingers internally. And if it's on network shares, like it'll be hard to keep that quiet. like you could really rile a company up over, you know, several months to a year.
Mm-hmm. So you get them, you get the employees to turn on themselves.
Yeah.
What they're saying before.
Yeah. Huh. Mm-hmm. I mean, because if you're going to do that, if you've got that access, you could start, you know, doing fake emails and deleting it out of the sent box so they have no idea they sent it.
You know, this is something else that, you know, if you're really into the corporate espionage, you know, deep into that kind of stuff, where you're doing thorough analytics on a company or whatever, you simply identify key individuals within an organization which are really making that place successful, they're really moving the ball forward for them. And those are the people you're targeting with this kind of attack.
Yeah. This is something we're going to talk about in the next episode, but that point, that part in Demon where the guy talks about, you know, how every person in power has a secret video of them doing something illegal.
Right.
Although frankly, we're almost getting to the point now where you can do that with deep fakes. So it's going to lose its impact, right? Because now soon it'll be like anything that's inappropriate. Oh, well, that's just a deep fake.
Right. Well, that really depends on how it flushes out in the court system, I think, as to where the burden of proof is going to lie. You know, is the burden of proof going to be to prove that it's a fake or prove that it's not a fake? Mm. So it would be interesting to see how that flushes out and who gets these, I don't know, necessarily upper hand is the right way to put it, but you know, which way that the scales tilt as far as that goes.
Man, can you imagine? I don't even know how you would prove that it was fake. Like, how do you, I don't know. All right. We've talked long enough.
But now the last thing, you know, say on this is that we could run into a scenario also where you have criminals that are attacking their own machines and planting the malware so that they can claim any evidence found out the machine was actually planted by the malware versus something that they were actually working on.
Have we actually, has that ever happened that we know of where like they've installed, you know, like a backdoor or VPN software on their system and then claim that they weren't actually the ones doing it?
I did not research it, but I would suspect that someone has thought of this.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm a criminal mastermind or anything.
Yet.
I mean, I am not a criminal mastermind. Just make note of the date and time. All right. So why does this matter? So keep an eye out for the, you know, if you're a forensics examiner, make sure you consider this when you're looking at the forensic stuff. You know, maybe it's not as highly likely as you would think, but it's always a possibility that things at first are not what they appear to be.
Can you imagine if they remove the malware after they planted this too?
Yeah. Well, that goes with the quality of these people we were talking about before.
Yeah.
You know, not high up on there.
Yeah. Plan it and then clean up after yourself. And...
Right. But one of the other things I will say is that if they could do this for regular evidence, why couldn't they not do this for IOCs for other threat actors? Where one threat actor will make it look like another threat actor is actually the one that did the compromise or the attack to shift blame away from themselves. And this is one of the things that a lot of people have complained about for attribution. That attribution is really hard because it's all virtual and it almost entirely can be manipulated to look one way when it's actually another.
Yeah. Anti-forensics. So, and I think especially in companies, if people are getting extorted with this, they're going to be really, really, this is going to be really, really afraid of telling anybody about this. Because even if they know that they didn't do it, like all the evidence is pointing to them. And that's something where if you whisper about it in a company, like it's going to ruin your reputation completely.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You don't even want whispers that, you know, oh my God, did you hear what was found on, you know, Jonathan's machine? My God, that son of a bitch.
This is a typical, you know, movie trope where, you know, someone is framed and they don't want to go and talk to the police because all the evidence really looks like they actually did it and they don't know how they were framed and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, so it depends though. There's lots of things that I would be fine going with the police to because like it's ridiculous but this one, like, and this one is just such a black mark that, you know, if it's attached to your name and any kind of email like headline or anything like that, like you are potentially ruined forever.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And if you should go to jail for it, oh, forget about it. Yeah. It's all over.
Yep. So yeah, I can see if somebody tried to blackmail me like this, this would be one where I'd be like, oh shit, I'm just going to wipe my entire computer and change all of my email and yeah, destroy it all.
Yeah, burn it down. All right. And our third article is the U.S. to attack cyber criminals first, ask questions later if it protects victims. And of course, based on that headline, you know it came from The Register. So the DOJ revealed a policy that it plans to undertake preemptive actions against cyber threats. And in the same speech, they also mentioned the creation of two new teams to prevent the abuse of cryptocurrency. The abuse of cryptocurrency. So, and the quote comes to us from the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa O. Monaco, in a speech that she gave. And what she says is, and this is a quote, whether to disrupt actions against cyber threats, even if they might otherwise tip the criminals off and jeopardize the potential for charges and arrests. So what they're saying is that if, and this is something you see in the movies a lot also, is that, oh, the criminal is about to do something heinous and the government can either act in order to stop that heinous activity, or they can document it and then arrest the guy later. The DOJ is saying, well, we will stop them from doing that heinous act and possibly compromise our ability to arrest those that person or that group of people in order to save victims. And I'm sure I really tried to find the article I read on this a few years ago, but I was having a really hard time finding it. But a couple of years ago, there was a stock trading company or a stock brokerage that had been compromised for 2 years, and the FBI was aware of it, but they failed to notify the brokerage firm so that they could collect evidence to arrest and prosecute the criminals later. So I'm sure that company really wishes that that had been the mindset or the policy of the FBI years ago when this happened, because I'm sure they suffered a lot of loss from, and both they and their customers suffered a bunch of losses due to those hackers being within their network for that long, that amount of time.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. So the FBI before this had no responsibility to notify the victims. Their responsibility or their goal was to catch the bad guys always, even if that meant letting victims get victimized even further.
That would seem to be the case, because the way that she couched this in her speech was, this is the policy change. And there'll be a link in the show notes to her speech, which is on the Justice website, Department of Justice.
Considering that they frequently don't get all the stuff back, or in the case of the attacker stealing personal PII or PHI, like once that stuff's out, it's just out. That is an interesting policy.
Well, I mean, they're better now. They're changing their policy. So we're all thinking. And the example that she gave in her speech was providing decryptor keys or seizing servers used to further cyber attacks as possible interventions.
Yay. Good for them.
Yeah. I'm kind of torn on it because I do like the idea. I think the implementation is really what we'll have to see on how this works out, because if they jump the gun and do whatever it is, preventive action they think they're taking against who they believe is the bad guy, when it may not be, they could really harm someone else in the course of that action. So
yeah, we've talked about this before, right? It's when you're attacking the server of the bad guy, you're not really attacking the server. You're attacking the server of the small business in, you know, Wisconsin, whose web server was hacked.
Right. And in her speech, she actually gives the example of them using a warrant in order to take down a botnet. I forget which botnet now, because I didn't put it in my notes. But I think they did that, what, last year or the year before?
Yeah, I remember there was a big fuss about it.
Yeah, and that was her example. And they got a search warrant, is what she said, in order to do that, which is kind of an interesting mechanism.
Well, I guess there's not like a hack back warrant yet.
Not yet.
A pre-kill warrant? I get permission to shoot somebody because the mentals, the psychics are saying that he's going to kill somebody. Got to kill him first.
Yeah, you mean pre-crime?
Minority Report, pre-crime. There we go.
Yeah, I don't think they, in Minority Report, it wasn't a kill thing, but yeah, it was arrest him for pre-crime.
No, but I mean, that's if they're that confident in it, you know, why go to all the expense of arresting him? Might as well just shoot him.
Well, I mean, why are you going to shoot them when you can just tie it into the automated drone network and just drone them?
Yeah. That's cheaper than sending a human. Less paperwork.
Probably. Probably. And if you get a discount on missiles, you can make it even cheaper.
Oh, boy.
Speaking of which, another statement that she made in her speech, which I found a bit disconcerting, was that she wants DOJ people to work at U.S. Cyber Command and elsewhere to achieve unity of purpose and action. I found that very disturbing, what you're doing is you're blending law enforcement with military action at that point, when they're two distinctly different things.
Yeah, and they've got very different areas. Like, law enforcement's supposed to be focused internally and military is supposed to be focused externally. Although that does kind of match a little bit with the next point, which you haven't made yet, which is that, frankly, a lot of these criminals are in external countries. Maybe they're going to use the military to hack back the ones that are external.
That could be. But, you know, having been in the military, I would tell you that the military mindset is not the law enforcement mindset. And
I thought it was shoot first and ask questions later, and both of them.
Well, it's supposed to be in the military, but not in the law enforcement, who are quote unquote peacekeepers. But when I was in the infantry, we said our purpose is to close with and destroy the enemy. That was our function. That's what we did. That was our one line item. If you forgot all other orders, all other commands, that is what you did. You close with and you destroy the enemy, which is not supposed to be what the purpose of law enforcement.
I hope not.
But along with that, what she said was charging and apprehending cyber criminals will still be a priority in cybercrime cases. So at least they say that they're not going to just, you know, murdering them is not a priority, it's charging them. But different tactics are needed when threat actors seek safe haven in rogue countries or work on behalf of foreign governments. And I think this is kind of the point of her speech, highlighting these new tactics or these new processes for what they're going to be doing. Because the idea, at least when they're talking about rogue countries or foreign governments, is that there's an inability for the FBI to facilitate law enforcement action in these places. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially if, like, Chinese or Russian actors. Russia's not going to extradite them. China's not going to extradite them.
Well, maybe. And I think this is where, you know, the U.S.'s inability to actually perform diplomacy has failed us, because it doesn't have to be that way. It wouldn't have to be that way. And in her speech, she mentions this, but she fails to indicate, you know, when you go through and read her speech, she talks about, oh, well, we work with France, Germany. She lists all these countries doing this thing. And, you know, and she does this in a couple of different places. But when she comes down and she talks about their work on the Revil ransomware gang, she says, in November, together with several of our international partners, i.e. Russia, she doesn't actually say Russia. She just says international partners. We disrupted the Revil ransomware group with 5 arrests and the seizure of $6.1 million in alleged ransomware payments.
Yeah, so, but I'm sure they did something to piss the Russians off first.
Possibly. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know what's in the minds of either of these two, the U.S. government or the Russian government, so I couldn't say. I
thought you were psychic last week. When did you lose it?
Well, I did hit my head. But it's interesting that you know, she mentions the rogue countries and foreign governments before she mentions this, when she talks about international partners and she lists countries before this. It's like she doesn't want to, because the thing here is that if she had said here that the DOJ worked with Russia in order to bring this group down, and then she says, oh, well, we can't work with rogue countries or foreign governments, they seem contradictory to each other, because they did actually do this, which means they could do it, but it's like, I mean, my disdain for law enforcement is probably pretty well known to anybody who listens to this podcast by now, but they're lazy sons of bitches and they just don't want to do the work in order to do that level of coordination, I think, as well as the overall U.S. government making these international relationships worse with their poor diplomatic efforts or their lack of diplomatic efforts. But if you take that quote was in the article, But if you look to the speech that she gave and you look at the broader quote, I think it sounds even worse. So she says, arrests, convictions, and incarcerations provide a serious and personal deterrent to criminals. I dispute that. And they are unique. They are the unique responsibility of the Department of Justice. Combining these and other tools you've heard me describe today makes us nimbler in disrupting the cyber threat. This is especially true when threat actors seek safe havens in rogue countries or work on behalf of foreign government. And I think that last statement really is what's missing in the previous context. Especially true. And that the way that that is worded to me says that it's especially true in these cases, but that's not the only case in which these tools will be utilized.
Yeah, but this to me is where CyberComm comes in. So they find evidence that they can't deal with it themselves, and they pass the information on to CyberComm, and CyberComm's going to go and punish them instead.
Right. Well, maybe I'm not stating this well, but what I'm saying is they say this is especially true of threat actors seeking safe haven in rogue countries or working on behalf of a foreign government. So that is the case where you get CyberComm involved. And when they say especially true, the way that I read that means this is not the only time it's true.
Oh, I see.
It could also be true when threat actors are not seeking safe haven in rogue countries or working on behalf of a foreign government. So I think this, at least the way that she has worded it here, leaves wiggle room for them to utilize these quote unquote tools in the United States. But of course, that is my obvious paranoia coming through, maybe. But moving on to the cyber, or the, what did they call it? The teams to prevent the abuse of cyber or cryptocurrency, excuse me. She announced the creation of the Virtual Asset Exploitation Unit, the VAXU, which will combine cryptocurrency experts into one nerve center that can provide equipment, blockchain analysis, virtual asset seizure and training to the rest of the FBI. And this unit will work alongside the FBI's other unit, which is the existing National Cryptocurrency Enforcement Team, which formed a few months ago.
They're pretty late to the party there, but I guess I shouldn't really be surprised, should I?
What do you mean? So they should have created these units a long time ago, or what do you mean by the late to the party?
No, they're late to the party in that they only created a National Crypto Enforcement Team in 2021. That's all. Should have created it back, 2013 or so.
I don't know. It really depends on your point of view on that, because I don't think the creation of a unit necessarily means that they're doing this better than they were, because they could have been tackling this problem differently before, and creating this virtual unit or these new departments or whatever, simply adding more bureaucracy may actually make this thing less streamlined or less useful.
That's fine. So this is just an exercise in what, like, that's what I'm looking for. What do you call it when some kind of, but when they build, when they're fiefdom building, domain building,
kingdom building,
yeah.
Empire building.
Right. Yeah. Somebody started building themselves.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Nice, because what I didn't mention here, which was in her speech, was the new department head for this section. So someone else gets a deputy directorship or whatever within the FBI.
Congrats to them.
Yay.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of the Army. So this is probably before a lot of people's time, but in the early 90s, right after the after the Berlin Wall collapsed and the Soviet Union fell apart, the Army was vigorously downsizing. I mean, they got rid of several divisions. Unfortunately, I just thought about this right now, so I don't have the numbers in front of me. But the Army got rid of many divisions within it, and it downsized how large it was because the Soviet Union was gone. And obviously, the necessity to have an extremely large standing army was not there anymore. So every Army division is headed by a general. Depending on the division, it'll be a 2 or 3 star general. So the Army is X big, you know, has, let's use some arbitrary numbers here. Let's say they have 20 divisions in 1990. And in 1995, they have 10 divisions. Do you know how many generals were employed by the Army in 1995 and in 1990?
It was either the same or it went up.
Yes, it was the same.
Yeah. No, I mean, this happens. My wife teaches at a local school district. One of the things she's commented on is no matter how many teachers and schools they need, the number of administrators, the number of people in the central office goes up and up and up. She used to work for a very small school district in Central Virginia. Central Virginia is not terribly inhabited. They're very small counties. And I think between the time she started and when she left, they like quintupled the number of people that worked at central office and did not change the number of teachers. So,
yep, I've heard that before. That usually it's like a 3-to-1 ratio, I think, administrators to teachers.
Yeah, I have no idea what it is, but I know that that is definitely something. There's always reasons to have more administrators.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I went to a very tiny country school, and I think the number of administrators may have been, and this is included like janitorial staff, half dozen, maybe. Mm-hmm. And the number of teachers was probably 3 times that.
Yeah.
You know, the way you would expect it to be, that the educators are actually, you know, who you want the most of versus paper pushers and bureaucrats.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing they talk about in the Army, right? We're in the Army. What do they have? Like 9 people for every frontline shooter. So the Army is very sort of logistics heavy as opposed to, you know, mayhem causing soldier heavy.
Yeah. I think it's like 10-to-1 support to combat people that get them food, you know, transport their fuel, et cetera, et cetera. And that's kind of funny that you consider that in the military now, because in including that 10-to-1 ratio, there's also a ton of contractors. So it's probably more like a 15-to-1 ratio, because during the 80s and earlier, there were a lot of jobs that had soldiers performing those jobs, which have since been outsourced to contractors, that contractors do that work now. So in addition to the 10-to-1 support soldiers to combat soldiers, you have the additional contractors as well. So it's probably more like a 15 or 20-to-1 ratio of support personnel to combat troops now.
Yeah.
Anyway, man, we got way off track on that one. But the announcement of these 2 units comes in along with the announcement on the 8th, and we talked about this last week before, of the arrest of the tech entrepreneurs Lichtenstein and Morgan for that, was it $6 billion theft from the cryptocurrency exchange in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And along these same lines, she mentioned, we'll also, and this is a quote, we will also call on all companies dealing with cryptocurrency. We need you to root out cryptocurrency abuses. To those who do not, we shall hold you accountable where we can. And this sounds kind of chilling to me, because they're saying, we want you to do our job and root out cryptocurrency abuses. And yeah, if you don't, we're coming after you.
I mean, this is almost like the know your customer laws for banks, right? And the report suspicious transactions for banks, except the difference is that there's no laws for the cryptocurrency yet. They haven't quite figured that out yet. So that seems like a very dangerous thing for her to say, given that there's no regulations.
And also, what's an abuse?
Yeah. Well, again, you need those regulations to define what's an abuse. I'm sure it'll be something like, you know, holding crypto in like a hardware wallet, or using any privacy-based crypto, or transferring more than $600 in crypto to somebody. I'm sure that'll all be reportable every time you transfer crypto in and out, so they can easily, you know, track it.
Yeah, I don't doubt it, but it doesn't please me for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, why should anybody care about this? Is you could be caught in the middle here. So as Matt was saying, that, you know, if you have an attacker who's commandeering one of your systems to do an attack against someone else, and the government doesn't do their due diligence in order to validate that that's just a hot point for that attacker, they may end up impacting your business.
Yeah. Can you imagine that they like ransomware or crypto locker your server so you can't use it anymore, so the attacker can't use it to attack anybody? I know that's not what they said they would do, but you know, like
it's kind of, and think about this in the context of the article we just talked about, where, you know, evidence being planted as well. But I think to your point that you were just talking about, I think, you know, this is something that we're not going to talk, we can't get too in depth here, is that NVIDIA article you sent me earlier today.
I was going to spring that on you in a minute.
Yeah, where the ransomware gang is accusing their target of ransomwaring them.
Yeah. NVIDIA suffered an attack. The attackers supposedly pulled a terabyte of data from NVIDIA, including passwords and hashes and stuff like that. And now they're claiming that NVIDIA has ransomware them somehow. I know that somebody in the Twitter feed was claiming that it may have been a canary-like thing. Like maybe part of the data that was pulled back was, you know, drivers for NVIDIA, and maybe one of the drivers was actually malware, you know, just in case somebody ran it.
It's interesting.
I don't know how else they could have done it. I mean, I guess technically they could have maybe just put a canary in there that dialed back and they saw what IP address the data was being stored on. But again, if you hack back there, you don't know you're actually hacking the bad guy's system.
Yeah. And you know, that thing about the driver being malware, that makes me nervous, and makes me think about, you know, booby traps in the United States. Strictly illegal. You cannot booby trap your house. So if someone breaks down your door, they get a sledgehammer in the nuts. I mean, in the face.
Hilarious. And the other one is illegal. No, they're both illegal. Sorry.
Yeah, right. So you cannot booby trap your house for something like this. And the idea that within someone's software suite or within their network, they would plant a Trojan, which would essentially be a booby trap for someone if they stole it. Very interesting concept that I think would, you know, probably end in more bloodshed and tears than joy and hugs, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Because like, I can see the booby trap thing. I can see that one making more sense than their red team actually turned around and broke in and then ransomed their, like, that's ballsy. Whoever ordered that in NVIDIA.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is all just accusations so far too.
Yeah. Yeah. But wild speculation is what we're known for here. So.
Yeah. You know, it could be interesting though. This is actually the ransomware crews eating themselves, where you hear about these guys that are going to get a huge payday because they've ransomware NVIDIA. So you ransomware them and they're like, hey, you want that payday from NVIDIA?
You got to pay us. That's hilarious.
You know, it's the honor among thieves thing. Not working out so well.
That actually makes way more sense than NVIDIA hacking back. Cause I can't imagine NVIDIA, anybody at NVIDIA that talked to a lawyer being like, yes, let's do this.
Yeah. I mean, you're not talking, I mean, NVIDIA is huge. They're a multi-billion dollar corporation. I do not expect them to do something like this.
Yeah, but anybody
did... ironic. It would be kind of ironic though. They ransomware this company and they end up ransoming their decryption keys. Like, hey, you just screwed yourselves now because we can't get your decryption keys because you encrypted them.
I mean, maybe they ransomware themselves accidentally. They accidentally ran an executable and they're blaming
that
NVIDIA.
That actually might make more sense. That's probably, you know, it's one of those things where the simplest is obvious, it's Occam's razor.
Yeah. I could, you know, where I could see this happening though? Is in like a hot shit startup or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where if they get ransomware, like their startup is gone and you've got a lot of talented people that, and you don't have a lot of oversight. You don't have an HR department yet. You don't have lawyers yet.
Yeah. And they're all like 22 years old.
Yeah. They're like, no, we're going to get this back.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on that one?
That is it.
It is well, that looks like all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.